Hi, everybody. Katie here with John A. Light Sink or Swim. And John, I have an important question to ask you right off the bat. Did you change your life?
Yes, I did.
Awesome. Awesome. And we've got somebody else today, Alex Trauger, who's 24 years old, and he did the same. And John, maybe you could tell us how you two met.
I have friends that I grew up since we're kids, the Jones family that we've been best friends since we're literally 7 years old. And we always stand by each other over the years. And anything that, since we're working with kids and trying to help people save lives, they told me an interesting story about Alex that was involved with one of the girls in the family. And they stayed friends with him, you know, through the whole family. And they said, you got to hear the story. And so they told me some of it. And then I called Alex and I spoke to Alex about it. And he's very articulate, sharp. He's got a new life and he tells a good story. And really, this is exactly what we're talking about. Young guys like himself that overcome the adversity and moves forward and he's giving back. And that's the biggest thing, talking to other kids and people that can understand some of his struggles so they understand what they may be going through, how to overcome it. And hopefully after they listen to his story today, they'll understand not the only one in those situations. And by the way, for the people that see this shirt, it is, can you read it?
Yep, this shirt saves lives.
This is for St. Jude's, for anybody's interested in donating with them also. I'm a big advocate and I try to donate to them. And I ask people that want to donate to us personally, we don't want it. I'd like it sent to the show, sent to people that need help in rehabs or something positive to continue giving back to somebody else. So, hey, Alex.
Yeah, and Alex, I have to tell you, I have kids about your age, and so I'm so excited to hear about your life and all the good things that you're doing, because I think sometimes your generation gets a bad rap, and that's not true for everybody. So tell us all about you.
Yeah, man, there's a lot of kids my age, you know, and a lot of the time you think of the less I would say savorable ones, you know, and that's just your opinion on it. But there's a lot of kids my age doing the same as me, doing more to me, doing less than me. You know what I mean? But yeah, like the small, like a small little snippet, you know, I was, you know, the topic, I guess, is, you know, changing your life around. My struggle was addiction. And, you know, it took me to places I thought I never would be. You know, it was a horrific, you know, like just downtrodden area in my life and in my mind. And, you know, it was, I didn't know, it couldn't be real. It couldn't be real. Not with my upbringing, not with, you know, my childhood, but everything that I thought wouldn't come true came true. And it was just a horrific time. And, you know, with a lot of, you know, dark and deep, dark places and a lot of rock bottoms later, you know, it brought me to the place where I thought, you know, I really need to make a change before, you know, that decision was made for me.
So let me ask you a question, Alex, for the people who know. Well, your parents, are they together?
They are.
And where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the suburbs of South Jersey.
Would you say that you had just a regular, normal upbringing?
Oh yeah, beautiful upbringing. You know, it was textbook. It was, you know, white picket fence and everything, man. You know.
Siblings, brothers, sisters?
Yeah. I'm the oldest of three.
And what made you take your first drink, drug, and what made you carry into the next level, do you think?
I always had it in me to want to do the next big thing. You know what I mean? The weed at, like, you know, the teen years. And ever since then, it was, I want to do the next one. I want to do the next one. I want to get to everything. I wanted to, whatever I'm experiencing right now, like, this sobriety, this level of consciousness, I did not want to be in it by any means necessary. I wanted to stay out of this, you know, at all costs, basically.
Were you an athlete? Were you athletic?
Yes, I was an athlete. I ended up getting an athletic scholarship to a few colleges, and went to college for it, until I was politely asked to leave freshman year.
What sport did you play?
I swam.
And no, I'm just going to bang through some questions. And were your friends on the swim team? Were they guys that were doing drugs also? Was it a social thing with you and your friends?
I found the ones that were doing drugs. I made friends with the ones doing drugs.
Okay. And you guys hung together, played sports there. They got high together. And who took it to the next level? Was it you that wanted to bring it to the next level? Was it your friends that wanted to bring it to the next level? And when did you realize you guys were taking it too far and you knew you were a little out of control?
I would say it was always me that pushed it. However, it's a lot easier when you're in a crowd to kind of edge everybody on a little bit, to everybody thinking that that's the great idea, you know, power in numbers, I guess. And it just really, you know, like we kind of were just very naive to what exactly we were doing. You know what I mean? When it came
What kind of drugs did you start doing?
Oh man. I mean, you know, high school, it was, you know, the weed, the drinking, maybe some, like, you know, psychedelics here or there. And then, you know, like I said earlier, that next best thing, once I crossed that threshold, that's all I wanted to do. And then the next threshold was prescription pills. It's all I wanted to do. And that one carried for a very long time until I ended up finding what brought me to my knees. And that's heroin/fentanyl. And that's when everybody else stopped hanging out with me, because, you know, that was not everybody else's scene. That was a little too much for everybody.
Did you overdose?
Yes, I've overdosed.
And you're aware I lost my daughter of fentanyl recently, right?
Yeah.
6 months, for the people who are listening that don't know, some of your friends. So it's a real thing for the people that don't know or not at that level yet, where you start getting to a dangerous level and losing your life when you get to more serious drugs. And it's fentanyl mixed in with it, where the NARC sprays aren't working with different types of fentanyl now. And what would be your advice to the next kid that's you in high school? How do you give them advice to not to step over that, or to even begin to get close to doing what you did?
You know, I used to coach swimming. Since I've changed careers, I don't coach anymore. And, you know, I personally, nothing safe unless it's, you know, it comes in a beer can, honestly, now. Unfortunately, they put it in everything. Like literally anything you can imagine, you know. It used to just be like heroin, then now it's coke, and now it's pills, and now it's weed. Like there's just nothing, you know, like you can be safe about. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. They're, like I used to tell people, you know what I mean? Like you walk it through a mall, you know what I mean? Like you're going to walk past at least five people that have done fentanyl, have fentanyl, and most of the time they don't know it. You know what I mean? Like that's the nature of the disease, and it's just, you just gotta be so careful. So careful. Because most of the time, if you're at that point, you've already made your mind up, unfortunately.
That's, you know, what I was going to say, is I've always talked to my kids about the slippery slope that, you know, if you start with one thing, it's just going to lead, I guess they call it gateway drugs or whatever, where you just go from the next thing to the next thing, which seemed to be something you were interested in. So when you were in high school, did your parents have any idea what was going on, or how did you hide it? When did they find out?
Oh, they always knew. They always knew. It was just an ongoing battle of trying to catch me in the act. They have, they did a lot. But you know, like I said, I was hell bent on that. It was my way of life. It was my way of life, getting high and getting drunk, by any means necessary. You know, I've made that decision like almost a little over a decade ago. That was, you know, what I was going to do with my life.
You know? Alex, you perfected the, I believe you must have perfected ways of lying to your family, convincing them that you're not doing serious things. And for them as a parent, I know as a parent, you want to believe it because you're scared of it. You're hurt. You also want to try to save you, but at the same time, they want to believe your lies, I'm assuming. Is that correct?
Yeah, the lying itself, the action of the lying got very, very easy. It's every so often, because the lying, that's the survival skill. You know what I mean? Like that's with human beings lie to get out of trouble, to save ourselves. The hard part was every so often that guilt, once the high would wear off, or once the, you know, you gain your senses or you have a moment of clarity, like that guilt would wave in, you know what I mean? That was the very difficult part to deal with, which I then suppressed with more drugs and alcohol, you know?
The vicious cycle.
Katie, as a mom, and you know your son's out on the street like he was, what's going through your mind if you're waiting for that phone call to hear that was killed?
My older kids now actually live out of state, but I have to tell you, anytime I would hear a police siren, I just always held my breath for a couple minutes, hoping that I wasn't going to get a phone call for whatever reason, you know, car accident or whatever. But I do have one son at home yet. He's 17 and he likes to play games. And I was talking to some people about that. And in one respect, you know, I think he plays a lot of games, but on the other hand, he's not out on the street. And so I kind of balance it that way a little bit, that I know what's out there and it could be a lot worse. And I know, you know, trying to deal with somebody who's doing drugs and likes it would be much harder, I think, to undo than to have somebody not start in the first place. So yeah, I don't know what your mom was going through, but I just can't imagine it was good.
I tell you, Alex, and for the kids that are listening to this, or parents, and I hope there's a lot of both listens to this, shares this, that phone call that you get as a parent that I got, knowing that your daughter just, I say, was murdered by fentanyl, didn't know she took it, is basically the end of a parent's life. And for the child to understand, they need to be able to, and it's a hard thing to do, because they always believe they're never going to die from the use of the drugs, is to reach out and try to get help. There's people that'll support you. Your parents aren't going to hate you for it. They're going to look to hug you and love you and help you. And I think the fear of letting a parent down maybe is part of it. The ability as a kid to think you're invincible is part of it. But as a parent, there is no coming back from losing a kid like that. So for the parents that are listening, be vigilant. Reach your hand out as often as you can, because they're going to deny it to you as often as they can. Like Alex just said, you become good at trying to say you're okay and I'm just drinking, or I'm not doing it, or I'm only smoking. Well, you got a lot of litany of excuses, I would assume. But Alex, tell us the first time your parents got that call that you overdosed.
The time I overdosed, unfortunately, was in my childhood home. I left home at like 20 years old. I was out on my own for a little bit. I've already been to rehab before. And then after the first, I would say, you know, vacation, I call them, over rehabs in the beginning, I came home afterward, and they found me in my room. I was supposed to be at work by like 8 o'clock. And they wondered why I wasn't getting ready by like 7:30. They didn't hear me. And, you know, the next thing I know, I wake up in the ICU in the hospital and have no idea what's going on. You know, I got tubes down my throat. I'm confused. Nurses and doctors are holding me down because the first thing I did was try and get up and leave because I had no clue what happened. I didn't put two and two together until a few hours later after coming in and out a little bit, exactly what was actually going on, you know? But yeah, no, they never received a call. Unfortunately, they did find me. I had a stroke. The complete right, I couldn't feel the right side of my body for about a month. I had to learn how to walk and eat and swallow and drink all over again. But yeah, that was a tough one, for them and everybody, you know, involved.
Do you believe you're alive for a purpose?
I do.
So do I. And you realize the strength you have as an individual to save a lot of kids' lives, right? Especially because they can relate to you because of your age. They're not going to relate to me the way they'll relate to you. Your personal story, your history, your understanding of it. And I believe you are alive for this reason. Just like today, you do this one show and maybe you'll save one kid. And maybe you'll save more. But I think that's something you should think about. As every day goes by, that you're able to reach these kids that we can't. And it's a good feeling knowing that maybe you could save somebody's life, not to end up like some of the situations you were in. And thank God you're alive.
Yeah, you got to keep it to give it away. You know, that's the only way I'm on this earth, you know, like we said, is to share this. And the only way I stay on this earth is that I share this. You know, the second I forget about everything, you know, that happened and what went on is when that delusional thinking comes back and, you know, suddenly, you know, and now with the same knowledge I have right now, if I stop doing what I'm doing and making sure that, you know, I'm helping somebody else, fentanyl will sound good again. Unfortunately, fentanyl will sound good again. I promise you that.
That's what I was just going to ask you, is are you afraid that you're going to fall back into that?
I'm not personally afraid, you know, because I'm doing what I need to do today. You know, I have a job. I have, you know, a home with my name on the lease. I, you know, I'm a part of, you know, fellowships, and I'm a part of, you know, groups and stuff that we all, you know, make sure we're doing good. And if I keep up with that today, then I'm good today. If I do that tomorrow, then I'm good tomorrow. But all I got to do is just make it through this 24 hours. And then I do it all over again tomorrow.
Yeah. And you talk about that a lot. Just getting through one day sometimes is a lot.
It's your goal's got to be short. It's got to be 1 hour, one day, and worry about the next day, like Alex said, tomorrow. It's short goals. Who's your support system, Alex, besides these, you know, these institutes that you're involved with? And is there anybody personally that's your support system when you're weak, when you're upset? Is there anybody you go to when you call, you talk to? Is it a friend, sibling, parent? Who is it?
It's funny, depending on the situation with me, you know what I mean? There's a lot of close friends that I've had for years. You know, and there's also people that I've only known for a couple months, and I'll call them and talk to them, you know, depending on the situation, you know, and sometimes it doesn't even really matter who the person is. A lot of the time it's calling and saying what you got to say. And then you guys end up just, you know, just talking about whatever afterwards. It really just depends with me. I rely a lot on my mother because I owe her that. you know, I owe her enough to keep her updated on what's going on in my life. Same with my father and my brother and my sister, because I was very, you know, secluded from them for years. So I owe enough to keep them as connected as I possibly can now.
Is that your family behind you in that picture behind you?
That's a family trip up to the Finger Lakes. The last family trip before my grandmother passed. It was up at Keuka Lake up in New York.
Okay. Yeah. So what's your goals today? What do you do for a living? Where are you looking to be in 3 and 5 years from now? Do you have a plan?
What I do now, I work in fire restoration, which is something I didn't know anything about. I didn't go to school for. It's a very multidimensional business. You work with people who lost everything. You know, I talk to a lot of people as their house is on fire. And we provide everything from the day you go into the hotel room to lay your head at night to you moving back into your old house or your new house after everything's all rebuilt and said and done. This job was given to me by somebody who struggled the same as me, had the same past as me. He invested in me because I'm doing what I'm doing, and I, you know, handle myself in a healthy way, and I'm trustworthy, I'm reliable, I'm dependable, I'm accountable. All the ubbles, you know, I am today, rather than what I used to be. As far as goals, I am just, you know, I'm learning everything I can. There's a lot of things, you know, great money in it. However, it really makes me feel good sometimes when, you know, you talk to somebody and you finally get through to them that we're trying to help and we're just, you know, trying to make sure that everything is okay, make sure everything that they care about is taken care of. And then to finally see that, and then they accept that help, because it's a very complicated time for a lot of people. You know, we deal with fire damage, smoke damage, storm damage. I just boarded up 2 houses today, you know, 2 complete losses, the whole house, everything charred up inside, every window was knocked out. Not a stitch of clothing was salvageable. And I was a part of that process, and that makes me feel good. So I would like to see myself doing it for the foreseeable future.
So how long have you been clean? How many years?
This past January was 2 years.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's quite a long time.
Well, and all those attributes that you were talking about, that people believe in you because you're honest and trustworthy and all that, you know, your parents obviously did a great job raising you because you had all those things in you, and, you know, maybe had a little hiccup in life, but, you know, now you're you again, and I'm sure they're very happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you carry yourself well. You're articulate. Mm-hmm. You're the second best looking guy on the screen besides myself. Hey, so let me ask you a serious question. There's these drug zones that they're doing now where they're allowing people to go and shoot up and pick up their drugs. I think it's the most ridiculous thing this government's ever come up with. And I'll give my opinion why, and then I want to ask you your opinion of it. I believe when they're encouraging people to go somewhere to shoot up, buy drugs, be able to purchase drugs off of drug dealers outside of the situation, because it makes everybody go to one location. It brings criminals to that location also, and it brings the enticement of continuing to get high. That's not an area the government isn't working on curing people that are in trouble. They're enticing them to continue to get in trouble, continue to get high, to meet other criminals that are going to try to sell them drugs. The zones, these drug zones, only open at certain hours. Like drug dealers look at their watch like they're going to the bank, or drug addicts or people that are addicted. I hate to use the word drug addicts. People that have an issue and have an addiction, they're looking for drugs if the place is closed. And obviously I come walking over with a bag of dope, cocaine, pills, fentanyl, or anything else, you're going to take it from me. You're going to get indebted to me. And if you can't pay me, I'm going to ask you to do criminal acts with me. So to me, this is one of the craziest things this government ever came up with. It's not something where they should be paying for rehabs instead of sending $125 billion to Ukraine or to Jordan, to any other country that is useless and not helping individuals here. They're giving up on your lives. So I'm completely, obviously, against what they're doing and giving up on American kids' lives. What do you think about that?
So I live in Philadelphia. I work in one of these, I work inside one of these drug zones very frequently, Kensington.
I'm going to stop you a second. You know, I did Kensington Crisis. I did the documentary with a couple of people, John Ricciuti and a woman, Jill, and other people are involved in that project. Very, very successful documentary about Kensington. I'm also there with Sam Opizio, who's running for city council. And we're there trying to help out. People are on the street in Kensington. I mean, especially Sam, just recently I joined in with him. So I'm very familiar with Kensington. And for the people who don't know who Kensington, what Kensington is, they actually show that on advertisements in Mexico, not to do drugs. And they show Kensington, which is incredible to believe. A third world country showing our country, our major city. So, guys, I'm sorry cutting you off.
No, yeah. It's like you said, if you don't know Kensington, there's no way to explain it without you seeing it. It's a place where, you know, like 5-year-old me, I thought the world, everybody loved each other. I thought, you know, everybody, you know, played basketball together and everybody hung out and everybody was cool. And, you know, all the parents were, you know, like my thinking as like a 5-year-old, you know, sometimes I gotta, you know, return it at sometimes when I'm driving down in there, man. Because if you really try to digest everything that's going on out there, you'd go insane. I was obviously never in Kensington when it was good. I was never in Kensington when it was changing. I'm just in Kensington now. And it's a lot of people, you know, they really don't take into account that the people you see standing on the street and, you know, standing next to the burning trash and, you know, in a tent or underneath the L, like those are like human beings like you and I, you know. It's hard to kind of kick that thinking sometimes where it's like, oh, well, they're just, you know, they're just junkies. And it's tough for a lot of people to put like focus on that. I agree with you. It's an egregious thing to let an area just go like completely up to their own devices. And it's killing a lot more people than it's saving.
The politicians, the rocket science politicians that created these zones are basically saying your life or any kid's life that's there that's in trouble is not worth saving. We're going to just feed them those drugs until eventually they die or overdose, get murdered, go out and commit crimes to get high, not because they're criminals. And they're promoting it. And these politicians are clueless to say that some child's life or adult's life or some young man, girl, woman's life isn't worth anything. And I don't see how they can possibly put money into these zones and not into free rehabs or situations and therapy and somehow try to save some of these people that are out there, because there's a lot of them are very savable. There's a lot of them that want that help, and it's very expensive, you know, because you've been in rehab, to get to rehab, to stay into rehab. And sometimes you fall down, you got to get back in again, and you need support systems. What they're creating is the opposite. Again, this is why I'm against a lot of these politicians, because they disperse and throw away lives instead of trying to save these lives. And the people that, you know, are watching, again, that I would call your local congressmen, political politicians, and demand that these places get closed, and that money should be funded, and other funds from our government should be going into saving kids' lives, education, and into therapy, and boarding, free boarding for rehabs, not going overseas to other countries and just giving up on the lives here. 100,000 plus are dying every year, overdoses in this country, just to put the numbers back in perspective, and growing.
Yeah, like we always say sometimes, some me and my buddies and stuff, like, they make it way, way too easy now to be out there. I always like joke, like, if, because even like you're talking 2 years ago, it's way easier than when I was out there, you know. Yeah. 2-3 years ago, like if it was, if they provide the same stuff for me, if I was, when I was out there, it's hard to say if I would have, you know, be here sitting with you right now. It'd be really, really difficult to say, because it's just how easy it is to.
If I didn't know any better, I'd say they're intentionally hoping that people is the way to get rid of the problem, start to die, overdose, and lower their numbers as they go by opening these zones. And I hate to be cynical like that, but I don't see any other explanation of why they're doing this.
Yeah, what is their justification? What do they say? To keep them all in one spot so a block down is safe? Or,
well, it's not going to be safe, because if you're a drug dealer, you know all your clients are on that corner, in that area. It's not a corner. It's a whole area of people that are sleeping on the streets, getting high on the streets, shooting up on the streets, defecating on the streets. Everything's done on those streets. All kinds of drug deals are made on those streets. So it's not like one block. It's a mile of it, a half a mile of it. You have to go there. It's incredible. It's something you can't believe you saw. You would think you're in some sort of third world country that was just bombed, and people are living all over dirt and getting high, and these governments are promoting it. But again, Philadelphia is one of those corrupt cities that's running this country. 53 politicians were arrested in Philadelphia, so, and counting, and come back again and get reelected in. So when the intelligence level of our politicians are at such, then we know where we're at, we stand. It's really sad what they're doing to these kids. And Alex, that's why, again, your word means a lot more than you think. And as you repeat and people see what you're saying, hopefully they say it to their next friend, and the next friend says it to someone, and they speak about you. And, you know, that's the basis of this show, is to keep getting you younger guys and girls in to tell the how you overcame it.
After you had your stroke and you were in the hospital, was that what turned you around, or did you have more episodes that happened?
No, believe it or not, I still used after that. When I was in treatment as well, the opportunity arose, and I jumped on it, and that's when I was completely done. I didn't want to sit through, you know, with me, it was the rehabs. A lot of people, it's jails, or the general feeling, but I did not want to have to sit through one more intake process at a treatment facility. I didn't want to introduce myself to another therapist, at a treatment facility. I didn't want to sit through one more group at a treatment facility. I didn't want to, have another Zoom call with my parents, you know, sitting in a therapist's office there. I didn't want to, you know, have those conversations with my mother and father through the phone. Is this the last time? Of course, you know, I didn't have it in me.
So is this all through COVID?
I mean, the first time I went away was June of 2020. And the last time I went away was January 2021. So yeah, when COVID was still in the full swing, we still had to wear masks and everything in there, and you know.
So what is? But, so can you explain what it's like going into rehab and what happens?
Well, I mean, depends on the kind of person you are. If you're there voluntarily, it's a little bit easier, I guess, but. You know, a lot of people don't really talk about the withdrawal. A lot of people don't talk about like the loneliness you feel, the, you know, the awkwardness, the angst. It's, you know, just a very... Nobody goes in there with a smile on their face, having a blast. You know, I think that's pretty obvious. You know, everybody that's there, it's either the worst time of their life or not a great time. You know, but like a lot of the fellowship and situation you find outside of treatment. Everybody's very friendly with each other as time goes on. You get to know a lot about each other. You get to share your experiences with each other. You get to share your, you know, your hope. You know, it's a very fruitful environment for the people that want to be there.
So were you there voluntarily?
Every time I went, it was voluntarily. I never went to a psych ward, or I was never locked up and was court mandated to go. Did I want to be there? Absolutely not. In the beginning, it was kind of just to make sure the family was all right and, you know, off my back, and to, you know, make sure I still had my freedoms when I got out. Because I knew if I continued to stay out and do what I was doing, those freedoms would slowly, you know, slip away, whether, you know, I could control that or not. But being in rehab itself is just it's a very weird thing to describe, you know. You're with a lot of people that share the same problems as you, obviously. It's just the opening up part is hard for a lot of people, you know?
So I'm going to ask you about social media then and now. And I know, you know, girls are more adversely affected from social media. Did that play any part in what you were doing?
No, I wouldn't say me personally, because the nature of what I did, I have issues with drinking and smoking weed. I don't do anything. I'm clean and sober. However, the environment and culture of the party scene was never a pull for me. It never really bothered me because, you know, my party was different than a lot of those parties. My party was by myself, you know, in my room, or, you know, in a dark alley somewhere, you know, in places like Kensington and in Camden and stuff. That was my party. That's what was very enticing to me. And thankfully enough that's not, you know, the norm. So I didn't have to really struggle with that as much, but I do know a lot of people that really do struggle with, like, even like a Coors Light commercial on TV. A lot of people A lot of my buddies and stuff, they still get anxious. They still get, you know, they still get the sweats, or, you know what I mean? Like, they still, you know, struggle with that. You know?
When I was little, cigarette commercials were on the television, and, you know, they decided that that wasn't good to have out there. So they quit doing those. So, yeah, I guess that makes sense too, that that'd be difficult to have it in your face all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it, with things like we were just talking about earlier about, you know, like Kensington and stuff, and in you know, places like North Philly and you know, bad areas and stuff like that, that was very attractive to me in the beginning. That was extremely attractive to me. Because what we, like earlier, that was not my upbringing. That was not what I was used to. That was not what I was reared in. So it was, that in and of itself was a drug to me. Being a part of that, being around that, experiencing that, was a bit, you know. And it sounds silly to some people, but especially with people that I know that are from there, they're like, why would you want to, you know, like, be associated with that? We've been trying to get out our entire lives, and here you are, like, you know, loving it. But it's how it is. You want, like, the human beings want to experience something that they're not used to.
So you had the adrenaline rush just for the fact of doing it, not even the drug part. And they talk about that with men, especially, where, you know, they do daredevil things more than women do. And you just, you know, built differently. So, two questions. How did your siblings take this, and how are they now? You know, how are they affected? And then also, your swimming buddies, are they doing okay now?
Yeah, so the siblings, you know, it's like I guess, like, the theme too from the beginning. Sorry, my cat's running around. You know, they were brought up same way I was, same loving household and stuff. You know, my brother is a sophomore at Temple. My sister is, you know, doing her master's for medicine at Delaware. You know, they, but we still are very involved in each other's lives and stuff. You know, they saw me, and I guess they saw me sort of devolve, you know, a few years ago. And it's a tough thing. Cause one, there was no talking to me. I was a tornado of a person, destroying everything in my path. Everybody that loved me, everybody that cared about me, I was just a terror, you know? So it was tough to kind of get through to me and talk to me on stuff like that.
Right.
And I I'm surprised they didn't avoid me more. If at all, that if they did, they really never, like, avoided me. It was just kind of like, I was very, you know, standoff for a very long time. But if,
so they never got sucked into what you were doing?
No.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. You know, thank God that they didn't, you know, weren't affected by the same disease I was. Cause, you know, I put them in a lot of bad situations. You know, I was not considerate enough to, you know, take into account that, you know, this is my brother and sister, and I shouldn't, you know, be succumbing them to this. Because if I was my own brother, I'd I wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. I would go nowhere near me in that time.
I have to say, you have a lot of courage to be so young and talking about this so openly. It's, you know, the for the things that matter and the people who care, I think you're just an awesome person.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was never ashamed of it, I guess. I'm not secretive about it, because I don't think that that's, especially what me and Johnny were talking about earlier. The more we try to hide feelings like this and try to, you know, put it in the past is not putting us in a better situation for the future. You know, being open with it. There's a lot of people that you know, hearing someone else talk about it and stuff that they will, you know, take into account for when they are, you know, presented with these kind of situations and stuff. You know, like I said too, some people just have it in them. Some people already made the decision that they're going to do what they're going to do. But there's a lot of other ones that sometimes just hearing somebody else talk about it, they will be turned off to it. You know, and, you know, fortunately enough that, you know, sometimes that does work. But for the latter, it you got to experience what you got to experience, you know. Yeah.
Well, and that's what, you know, like John was saying, is, you know, somebody your age talking about the perils of this whole thing is so important because, you know, you're gonna connect with younger people. So yeah. So your swimming buddies?
Yeah, swimming buddies, man. We're still tight. There's a lot of them I still talk to. I didn't really get into like the fentanyl and all that stuff until I was already, you know, home from school and you know, haven't touched the pool in like, you know, a year and a half. So I didn't really expose them to that as much. But, you know, they all either still in college or finished college. I still went back to finish. You know, they're doing good, man. Fortunately enough that they didn't struggle. They know when to stop. They know when to put it down. They know when to not pick it up. Which is, you know, some people take that for granted. Because like I said, once I was going, or once I made my mind up there, I just couldn't stop at all. I was the first student to party. And I was the last student at the party every single time, every single party, they asked me to leave because I overstayed my welcome.
Oh. Yeah. I'm sure it's a personality thing a little bit too, to know yourself, but you know what, you put that in the right category, in the right lane, and you'll do wonderful things in the world.
Yeah. Just yeah.
Focused in the right way.
Yeah. I hope.
So do you have a way for people to contact you, or do you not want people to contact you, or?
Oh, people can call me, talk to me. You know, I'm on the phone most of the day. I don't know how you want to do it. You put my number out, or, you know, I only have Instagram really.
Okay, what's your Instagram handle?
I think it's my first and last name. I think it's Alex Trauger. Alex Trauger.
Okay. Yep. I'll put that up on the screen then.
Yeah. And you can put my number up on there too.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
that sounds good. So anything else you want to share with people?
Like, listen, man, it really depends on how you look at it. There's either way more people dying than getting this thing, than figuring it out. Or you look at it that there's still people figuring it out. You know, it just really depends on, you know, how you look at it and what you want to do about it. The conversation is always there to have. The more we keep the conversation going, you know, the our better our chances to that it doesn't stop. Don't be afraid to be open about what's going on with you. Don't be afraid to be open about what happened to you. This goes way, way deeper than drugs and alcohol. This is mental health. This is, you know, disorders. This is childhood. This is everything. This is everything. Everything is in the mental health world is connected in some way, shape, or form. And until we actually can fully understand each other, it's going to be a lot harder for it to get, you know, even better in any semblance of that.
Well, and I think your generation is much better at that, talking about mental health, than my generation, for sure. Did you ever see the show called Mom?
My mom watches Mom.
Yeah, that is, that show just cracks me up because they say things that, you know, you're thinking, but you would never really say out loud. But it really is, they do touch on some pretty sensitive subjects sometimes. And obviously they're all recovering alcoholics on the show and other things, I guess, drugs and stuff. But it's a good show because it does, like you said, keeps the conversation going and, you know, puts a little humor with it at the same time to get through it. So.
Yeah, it's my thing is exposure is everything. You know, you don't learn about anything unless you actually listen to somebody talking about it, or you make an effort to, you know, research it, or, you know, involve yourself as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. So do you speak to any school kids, middle school, high school kids?
No, I haven't done any speaking things along that lines. I speak at treatment facilities. I have a couple commitments where I'm going to be speaking at a couple prisons coming up. So, but yeah, no, I haven't really spoken at any schools. So far, I'm more than open to it, you know. However, you know, it's just one of those things. It hasn't approached itself yet. So sure. I'll just wait and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's great though. We'll have to stay in touch and keep everybody abreast of what you're doing. So a lot of good works. It sounds great. So I want to thank you. John said thank you too. He had to run to another appointment, but thank you so much for coming on. I really was excited to hear that a younger person was coming on to talk about issues that matter in the world.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. You know, it's been great. I've never done one of these before. I've never talked on anything into a camera about like what's happened. But yeah, no, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Nice. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Have a good night.
All right. Thanks, Kath. I'll see you.
Bye.
So to wrap it up for today, and thank you, Alex, for being on the show. Again, another police officer was shot today and killed in New York City. This can't continue. There's got to be a fix for this. And this isn't America like this. And again, condolences to the police officer and his family that was killed today.
Where was that at?
New York City. It just came over to me on the feed. And for all the kids out there that is using drugs, addicted to drugs, or being murdered by fentanyl, to them and their families, please contact your congressman. We have to push our government to do more about this, to close our borders, as long as these drugs are coming in, killing everyone. And our politicians have stopped these drug zones. They're not helping, they're hurting. It's giving up on our children and on the people that are addicted. And the answer isn't to feed them more drugs, it's to help them to overcome them. Thank you, everybody. Please follow me on John Elite on Instagram, my website, johnelite.com. Please write. And if anybody needs anything, write us, comment on the show. Please press subscribe, and I'll see you next week. Thank you.
And I have to say, too, that, you know, I know people are going to love this show. And I always see memes on Instagram where they talk about, you know, it's like a quote from a mom saying, you know, whatever you need, my daughter, my son, you know, I'm always here for you. And it's great to like those memes, but it's even better to actually tell your child those things. Because, you know, when it comes to serious issues like this, you may think you have a good relationship, but they may not want to talk about it. But so instead of just liking the memes, share this video with people that you love that have kids that age that are impressionable, and you know, let them know directly with your own children that they can come to you and you're always going to be there for them no matter what.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. And again, in memory of my daughter, Chelsea Marie. Love you, honey. And this is always for you. This fight will continue. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you.